Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VCpreneur podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I'm your host Digjay, and today I have with me Pearl Agarwal, founder and managing director at Eximius Ventures. Eximius is an early stage micro VC fund that invests in startups across fintech, health tech, gaming and Web3. The fund has already made investments in marquee startups like EkaCare, Jar, Stan, Kalagato and Figo, among others. In this episode, Pearl talks about her path leading up to Eximius Ventures, the investment thesis and key focus areas at Eximius, the Web3 opportunity, parallels between a founder and a first-time venture capitalist, winning the trust of LPs and founders, building the foundation to scale up to a larger fund, and more. I had a great time talking to Pearl on the podcast, and I hope you enjoy this conversation too. So, without much ado, let's jump in and find out what Pearl has to share. Hey Pearl, welcome to the VCpreneur podcast. Thank you so much for taking out the time. Appreciate you being on the show with us today.
Thank you, Digjay. Thank you for having me. And it's great to be chatting with you today.
Awesome, Pearl. So, you know, for our listeners who don't know you yet, maybe we can start, you know, with a brief background about yourself. You know, tell us about your path leading up to Eximius.
So, of course, I'm Pearl Agarwal, founder of Eximius Ventures. Before I tell you a little bit more about Eximius, let me sort of take a step back and tell you why did we start Eximius in the first place and what led me to sort of get there. So I was born in a tier four town in Orissa, where, literally there were no corporates, no MNCs, and primarily all micro entrepreneurs, as well as solo entrepreneurs trying to build businesses and make their living. And that's where my parents owned a kirana store. And I remember at the age of 8, 9, after school, we would often go there and help them out. To be that another helping hand. And that is where I was introduced to that community of entrepreneurs that were all in that same area that would be working together and helping each other. And I saw them being so helpful and accommodating to each other, and the kind of vibe that existed was just beyond the world, right? And I think that was the first time I knew that, one, I wanted to be an entrepreneur going forward, because of that passion, the zeal that I saw in those folks. And second, also wanted to sort of do something that would help other entrepreneurs make it in their journey, right? Because it was a difficult journey. It was a lonely journey. And having a community around you really sort of helps you get through it. So with that thought, of course, that was a very young age to get into anything that would be serious, and had to sort of prove myself before coming back. So I made my way around to the US in around 2010 for business school. And then after that, started working at an endowment fund, which was University of Texas Endowment Fund. And that was the first time I was actually exposed to the other side of entrepreneurship, which is investing. We were investing $5 billion across 200 plus venture capital firms and private equity firms globally, met a lot of managing partners, 50 plus managing partners, to understand how they were thinking of building their funds, both emerging as well as, you know, successful ones that had 7-8 funds that they had raised. It was really fascinating to see, how all the way from sort of ground operations to top-down fund strategy was thought about and executed. And I think that was the first time I sort of also started to realize that it was more on the strategic side that I would want to help entrepreneurs. And I had a keen interest in the buy side or the venture capital side. But after that, to get a little bit more hands-on experience, I moved to Merrill Lynch, where we were doing mergers and acquisitions for middle market companies. So $100 to $200 million in revenue. Did few of those along with some capital market exposure as well. But as buy side had always interested me more, moved to a private equity fund in New York, which was a $70 billion private equity fund. We were investing across different stages and products. So early stage, emerging market, debt, as well as buyouts. Initially, I started my career with buyout transactions. So, you know, sort of take privates and partial take privates of conglomerates, and then taking out their cost centers, converting them into profit centers by bringing in more revenue sources and then relisting it. So a lot of deep hand-holding of those companies for 1 year, 2 years before we could turn them around and sort of relist it. But over time, I did want to sort of start moving more towards early stage and sort of more towards tech investments as well as India, because both were my passion from very early on. So in 2018, I got an opportunity to come to India for about 6 months in Bombay when we were planning to set up our office here and look for fund managers. So came here, met up with a few fund managers in India. But to be very honest, because my passion was towards entrepreneurship, I met a lot more entrepreneurs who were building for India and realized that the generation of entrepreneurs that were coming up were quite different from what we had seen back in the day. Back in the day, there were promoters and there were companies, and now we were actually seeing startups and founders. The way they approached company building was different. And one thing was clear after spending 6 months here was that the next decade was going to belong to India, and there's never a better time than that to come back and build something for the country. So the next year or so I spent in London sort of doing more investments across Asia Pacific, but had already started thinking about setting up Exenius. Of course, during this time, to be able to build credibility and to stay in touch with these founders, I did some angel investments and helped them more on strategic development, their go-to-market strategy, as well as operational help, more on my free time and, you know, as a side gig. Ended up sort of investing in about 15 companies across US and India during that time. But in February of 2020, sort of made up my mind about, I would say, 20-25 days before the pandemic to move back and make this more institutional and actually set up Exenius as a fund that would continue to help more entrepreneurs than I could do in my personal capacity. So I think, it's been about a year and a half since then, about 2 years now, and quite interesting both setting up Exenius as well as investing in 16 odd companies that we have since then.
Very cool. I think that's a very wide-ranging, diverse experience and a very thought-out plan, to enter the early stage of investing. And it takes, like you said, an approach of getting to understand the founders more, getting to understand, what they go through to be able to add value as a VC, not just with your, investment, but also just being able to identify the right ones and also be able to add value to them along the way. So, Pearl, let me start by talking about Exenius. I mean, the time that you started Exenius was also very interesting. We've started that push of extra capital to Indian startups, and a lot of new unicorns have come up over the same time period that Exenius started. What was your thesis and focus area, right, when you started Exenius, and has that evolved any bit over the last 1.5-2 years that you've started investing?
Absolutely. I would say that, both when we started fundraising and when we started investing was quite interesting, right? I think within 20 days of us wanting to set up Exenius, we were under a complete lockdown. And within a month of us launching our first fund, we saw the highest amount of capital being invested in the Indian ecosystem. So is it a good timing or bad timing? We'll see. But very interesting journey nevertheless. So for us, having sort of seen these 10 odd companies that I was working very closely with, it seemed that the fundraising journey was very difficult for founders. Often in the early stages, without capital, you're not able to hire a team. Hence, it's two or three founders that are really working on everything from hiring, building the product, as well as fundraising. And during that time, if one of the founders has to spend 2 or 3 months just raising capital, that initial sort of capital, it becomes quite difficult to really get past what I would call, you know, valley of death, right? Like actually build your MVP and start to sort of get that tested. And this is the area where we thought we could add most value and be able to help entrepreneurs just streamline that process and do it faster so that they don't have to, you know, the company should not die because they don't have enough capital. If they have to pivot because it doesn't align with what the customers want, that's okay. If you know, they're not able to sort of get to the right product, that's a secondary step. But the first step of just being able to get that bare minimum resource should be more easy than what I was seeing. And hence, that's a thought process with which we really started out. And, you know, I mean, spoke to multiple founders to understand how we could help. And what really came out were that the three or four areas where we could add value as a fund. And that is what we have built the fund around. The first is believe that, you know, in the first round, if a founder has to pitch to 100 plus angel investors to be able to collect 20 or 30 checks that would help him or her amass about a crore or 2 crore, it's extremely inefficient. So how can we sort of provide a decent amount of capital, be the first check, and do it fast? Do it within 3 weeks, 2 weeks, so that they have visibility. And of course, then they can think about adding more strategic angels onto the cap table and taking it from there. Second was around community, right? And with this thought process, we also launched another product called Dot Review, where we provide unfiltered VC reviews to be able to sort of bridge some information asymmetry and gap in the founder community. But a thought process there was that, you know, in the initial days, what a founder really requires is that access to community to be able to find the right folks to chat with about the problems that they are facing, people who have already gone through it, and access to folks that they can hire. And while as a VC firm, we can collate those resources and give it, the best way to do that is to create a vibrant community for them through which everybody can figure out what's the best resources they require and extract that. It should be much more efficient than what we would do. And the third is, of course, you know, what we had also started to see is that the founders that were building from India had the potential to build for the global market. And we wanted to be able to make that access to global network easier. And having spent time across different countries, we had that firsthand approach to be able to, you know, get them open doors for them in different countries. So it's, you know, these are three or four sort of key pillars that Eximius focuses on as we build and help entrepreneurs. But of course, within that, you know, that was another thought process of ours, that we would want to focus on micro theses where we are able to actually build more curated resources across community networks, so on and so forth, for specific sectors. That way, we're really able to bring resources fast rather than having to sort of spread ourselves too thin, right? So that's why we focus primarily on fintech, health tech, and gaming, and try to build grounds up resource for them. To just give you an example, within the gaming community, one of the problems that we identified is that while there is demand and the demand is growing with 450 million plus gamers, supply is yet to catch up. And that's because there aren't enough resources available with game developers and studios to be able to do that. So we went ahead and launched a group or an IP called the Gaming Lounge, where we brought in 40 plus game developers and investors from the global network, from spreading across 6 countries. We brought in a vibrant community of 400 to 500 people who are part of our Discord and WhatsApp group that some of these game developers can quickly test their product with. And, you know, also sort of have done surveys across different groups to be able to identify trends that can be utilized by game developers to build better. And with all of these curated resources, we believe that, you know, the gaming companies that we are funding or even not funding will be able to get the right resource, which at least help them take off in the initial stages. And we aim to do something similar for across different segments that we're investing in, so that our aim of making the journey easy is accomplished.
No, I think that's very helpful background, and also you know, kind of throws light on why a lot of early stage startups should look at Eximius. And I really appreciate like the depth of the understanding that you've, you know, you have now, especially being a buy side private equity investor and understanding the early stage of the businesses and doing that kind of research of, you know, what the founders would need at the earlier stages. And then positioning your fund around that and building resources, like you said, you know, the community, which is very important at the early stages, the speed of investment, which can define whether a startup dies or basically survives for a few more months before it gets that traction or proves out its MVP. And of course, the global network that you have because of your cross-border network. So I think that's definitely helpful background. I want to pick and talk more about the sectors that you mentioned, right? Gaming, of course, is picking up, especially with the Web3 layer around it that's been discussed so much. So want to, you know, also understand from you, one, like, are you looking at Web3 actively? And two, if yes, why do you think it's a very non-intuitive but wide opportunity and the right time to be investing in this sector today?
I think absolutely. We're definitely looking at Web3 and we are quite excited about the opportunities that Web3 has as well going forward. And where that really sort of comes from, in my opinion, is the way Gen Z's and the new gen really thinks about it. You know, we don't talk a lot about alphas, but the alphas are also coming up, right? Like folks that are born after 2010, they are around 12 years now, and they're going to become a little bit more active in the ecosystem going forward. And these are folks that had access to smartphones and digital access at a very early age. So they've always been exposed to their digital identity and don't necessarily differentiate that with their physical identity or their physical environment. What that means is that, you know, they're also a little bit more cognizant of how the data that they leave behind, the data trail, is being utilized and the impact that is having on the rest of the ecosystem. I think which is where that adoption of Web3 among the young generation really comes from. Because Web3 allows you to not just retain control of the data, but also see how that can be utilized for the betterment of the entire ecosystem. So what we believe is that, you know, while we are very early right now in the Web3 ecosystem, soon it's going to become the default protocol that Web2 at one point, you know, the same journey that Web2 was going through, right? So when we went from Web1 to Web2 and started using the likes of Facebook and sort of more interactive content, it took time for the mass network to start adopting to it. But today we don't necessarily sort of differentiate between the two. I think similarly, as we sort of see more and more people becoming a little bit more cognizant of the data trail, people would want to use Web3 as the default protocol, regardless of the use cases that are being built on top of it, whether it is social media, gaming, financial services, so on and so forth. Why non-intuitive? Which is a very interesting question, right? Because we're talking about Web3 today, but actively there are only 7 million people using DeFi products and 2 million or less people using gaming and other sort of social media products. So there's really less than 1% penetration at this point. And that has to do with the fact that the infrastructure needs to really massively adopt to users and bringing masses onto it. So far, it's a very small community of, you know, techies that are developing for techies, and adoption's also happening among people who are more technologically advanced. But if we want it to be a default protocol, that is where we believe the next 2 or 3 years will be spent, where people will start thinking more about how to improve user engagement, how to retarget users better, and build for better user experience, so that we can start increasing penetration. And just to sort of highlight in terms of areas that we are looking at as well, this is where we are more interested. That how are you really sort of changing the infrastructure or adopting the infrastructure to bring more and more people, one, and two, start to sort of engage with quote unquote more traditional companies as well today, right? Because unless you don't get two companies to start moving towards Web 2.5, Web3 is not going to be a reality in the distant future.
Especially companies that own distribution today, because that's one easy way to, you know, get access to people who are not necessarily, you know, tech savvy today.
Yeah, absolutely. You're completely right. And And we are seeing a lot of progress in that direction. I mean, the next gen of developers who are coming up, especially in the last 2-3 months in this bear market, are all thinking about how to build for larger mass than they were back in the day, I believe.
No, that's definitely helpful. Pearl, you want to talk about some recent investments that you made, not just across Web3 gaming, but also fintech, health tech, just to, you know, give our audience a flavor of what kind of companies that you're looking at and why do you think, they're unique and what's their mode going to be going forward?
I would say, all our companies are very dear to us, right? But if I had to, and I know we don't have the time to cover all of them, but if I had to talk about some of the recent investments that we are quite excited about at this point, I'd say the first one is EkaCare. It started by the founders of GoIBibo and the chief architect of Arogya Setu. So Vikalp, after having built Arogya Setu and handing that over to the government, decided that, being able to actually bring digital health content together is quite powerful in increasing affordability and access to healthcare and health services, especially across tier 3, tier 4. And that doing a fantastic job right now of building a digital connected platform for, I would say, the larger Indian ecosystem, right, where they've been able to penetrate, have access in 11 languages and have been able to penetrate not just across tier 1 and tier 2, but tier 3 and tier 4 cities as well. They essentially bring your entire offline health journey online through doctors that you're interacting with, the health records that you have with those particular doctors, as well as other labs that are generating those reports, so that you have a longitudinal health view and are able to sort of take decisions in terms of how to get a better 360 degree care for yourself. On top of that, of course, once you have all of this information, today one of the biggest concerns is out-of-pocket expenses, which keeps half of India away from accessing good healthcare. You'd also be able to underwrite better insurance plans through this and improve access. So we're quite excited about that. In fact, they just recently did a fantastic Series A, where they raised from the likes of Hummingbird and Mirai after having raised from micro VCs and angels last year. So I believe that the future of healthcare is going to look something similar to what Eka is building. I think outside of that, we've also invested in a company that I believe you might have already heard of, and a lot of the other folks listening might have heard of, is Jar. Quite exciting. You might remember that back in the day, we used to save our pennies and a small change in a jar and utilize that to buy things at the end of the month. But over time, as digital transactions started to penetrate further, the entire behavior was vanishing, right? With that, it meant that people who had a passive saving habit back in the day were also losing out on it. So unless you don't actively sort of put aside a portion of your income and invest it in a basket of stocks, bonds, so on and so forth, you really weren't saving as much, which was going to be a problem for millennials and Gen Zs going forward. So they're just bringing that entire offline habit online by allowing you to do micro savings by rounding off on the change that you might have had via digital transactions at the end of the day. I think phenomenal growth in the last 1 year. These guys have been able to get 8 million downloads, have reached almost 100 CR in AUM, and have done multiple rounds from the likes of Tiger Global and Arkham Ventures. Believe that right now they're just getting started. There's a huge market of almost 100 million plus people that can potentially benefit from the solution that they are providing. A lot of new products that can be added on top of it as well. So yeah, I would say that the list is ongoing. If you get me to talk, I can keep adding more and more to it. I'll probably take a pause there.
No, sure. Definitely, very interesting names. I've heard about that. I'm sure, if our audience hasn't, they should check them out. And yeah, I want to talk about, the fundraising side from here on. I think all this background definitely helps to also understand what went into building and pitching for the fund in itself. And, the journey of a VC itself is almost like an entrepreneur. It's not easy. It's, you know, it has its own share of challenges, especially when you're raising your first fund, right? And there are two important stakeholders broadly to manage, you know, LPs and founders. So let's talk about LPs first, right? People that are betting money on your judgment, the fund manager's judgment or and expertise as a fund manager, right? So tell us how rigorous was, you know, the process of raising fund one, and what was your primary pitch, you know, to LPs at the time? Especially also given the timing, right? Because it became so competitive at that point, like we discussed, you know, so much capital was coming through from late stage VCs going early, new early stage funds coming up, and also micro angel networks getting active in the ecosystem.
It was a very interesting journey. I mean, I remember that, you know, we actually incorporated Eximius in March of 2020. And within 7 days of my first LP meeting, we were under a complete lockdown. I took the first one on 15th of March, 22nd of March, everything had shut down. So literally, I, you know, sort of found myself sitting in my living room thinking what to do from here. How should we move forward? There was a time when people were, you know, I think Sequoia had come out with a Black Swan event report, and people were just very worried all across in terms of how the markets would react and what would be the impact, right? So overnight, our meeting started to get canceled. You know, being able to just pitch our value prop was becoming a little difficult. And of course, there was a time when I would wake up with this thought that, you know, tomorrow everything might vanish, right? Because that is where it is. To your point, it's very much like a founder's journey, where it's in the initial stages, it was me with a few interns, and everything dependent on how would I do and whether we'll be able to raise our first fund or not. But of course, after a couple months, things started to look different. Things started to change. People realized that digital penetration was happening at a much faster rate than before, which changed how some of the conversations you were having before also started to pan out, right? People became warmer to this ecosystem. Actually, people wanted to start taking bet to have that exposure, which they weren't getting in traditional sectors or other sort of public markets at that point. So there, our primary pitch again was you know, those two or three points that I mentioned before. One is today, I would say that, you know, an early stage founder's journey was probably easier only for the last 6 months or 9 months, probably, when we had an influx of capital. But outside of that, it's still being very difficult, right? Raising your first $500K or your first $1 million is probably a lot harder than raising the next $5 million or a $10 million round. And this is where we wanted to add value. We had a unique angle of being able to do that by, you know, improving the NPS of both funded founders as well as non-funded founders through the community, the grounds of approach that we were creating, where we wanted to work with them just like we were founders as well, and build that sort of a relationship. And with that, help them out in terms of scaling via a global network, and you know, build very strong thesis in some of the micro segments that we were excited about, that we believed had tailwinds post-COVID, not just during COVID, but post-COVID. And hence we stayed also away from some of the sectors that were being favored only during COVID, and had that vision, you know, 2 years ahead, that, that what are the sectors that will have long-term sort of tailwinds post-COVID, and what are the sectors that will only benefit during the lockdown period. And with all of this, you know, we're able to convince our first few sort of folks to take a bet. And all you require is those first set of believers, right? Once you have three or four LPs that believe on you, the rest of the capital sort of comes through. And fast forward, you know, 2 years, we've managed to collect 75 crores that we're looking to invest across 25 to 30 companies, and have also made 16 investments with two up rounds and three more that are on the way right now. So hopefully, we're not looking too bad for our LPs anymore.
Yeah, that's an amazing track record already, right? And if you had to, like, you know, share advice for people who are going into fundraising, right? Early stage VCs who are trying to raise their own funds today. Is there anything from your, you know, own fundraising journey from LPs in terms of strategy or approach that you think you want to pass on or you want to reiterate?
Yeah, I would say two things. One, What really helped in, I think I didn't mention this, was that I already had an angel portfolio of about 10 companies. I know it's a little difficult to be able to sort of allocate, capital in this direction, but being able to showcase to LPs that you're not just sort of betting with their money, but you've already tried and tested it with your own capital and you're serious about it. So being able to show that skin in the game is very important. And either you can, do angel investments or take small allocation as a part of syndicate to be able to do that, to show that seriousness. And the second is that people don't give enough value to it, but returns matter. What matters more is trust. When LPs are giving money, they want to know that you're going to treat their money like your own money. And of course, the bets that you take could play out, could not play out. That is a risk that they are willing to take. But being reckless with it is not something that anybody who is going to accept, especially for an emerging fund manager. So to be able to build that relationship and to just show that trust that you really care about their money, I think it goes a long way.
Yeah, and just wanted to double click on that. It's a very important point that you mentioned. And it's also a very soft aspect. You're not necessarily able to prove out how do you, show trust or prove trust to new LPs that you're, trying to pitch to. So just want to understand more from your perspective, right? What does it mean to, build that trust, and how should...
It's very, very fine aspects, right? To your point, how do you show something as intangible as trust? And that only happens over time. And it has to come from within. There is nothing called, fake it till you make it in terms of trust. It has to come from within, where every single action of yours during your interaction has to reflect that, yes, you might be doing it for the first time in this avatar, but you really care about succeeding to the best of your ability. And you not taking their money for granted, whether it is through conversations, to behavior, through seriousness that you show, it cannot be a one-time thing. It is built over time, and it shouldn't, trust is something that, difficult to gain, but easy to lose, right? So also making sure that there's that constant effort to continue to sort of keep with it and not just stop once they have given you commitment.
No, I think two very important points, that you mentioned, having that skin in the game, showing some track record, even before thinking of launching something like this, it was a long way. And like you said, earning that trust over time, being consistent, transparent, and showing that passion along the way, definitely helps. So thanks for that, Pearl. And, the other aspect that I was talking about is, the founder aspect. You spoke about community and how you've thought so much about the early stage, the difficulties that founders face at the earlier stages. But from a VC perspective, right, it's become so competitive, especially at the early stages now, with so many crossover funds, late stage funds coming in early. Like I said, angel networks getting active in the ecosystem. Deal flow becomes key differentiator, basically, to get good deals and thereby, outperform and bring out better returns to your LPs. There could be different ways of looking at it, inbounds versus outbounds. And just wanted to understand from your perspective, how do you think about, deal flow in general? And what's the, I would say, percentage of outbounds versus inbound, especially because when you're a first fund, probably you don't have that wide network of VCs or late stage or angel networks for that matter to refer you deals. So you might have to go more outbound versus inbound. But just want to hear, your thoughts about just deal flow in general and how you approach it.
I think that's a very good question and takes me back to the time when we closed the fund. We closed it again in March of 2021. And within 15 days, I don't know if you remember, April was, I think we'd gotten 10 or 11 unicorns in 1 month. That was the first month when things just went crazy. Suddenly we saw ourselves competing not just with micro VCs and angel funds, but also with large VCs that had started to put in capital at the very, very early stages, sometimes day zero. And so definitely at that point, really being able to sort of explain to the founders or show, not explain, but rather show to the founders what you bring to the table is very important. I think deal flow is important, but more so it's important to, after you've gotten a deal, building that, again, trust and relationship with the founders to give them a flavor of what it is like to work with you before they accept that check is even more important. So in terms of inbounds, I think inbounds were not a problem for us ever, right? Like back in the day, we had 150 odd per month. Today, we have 300 odd per month. But in terms of the companies that we have funded, definitely the proportion of outbounds have been a lot more than inbounds in terms of the funded portfolio companies. And that's primarily because as you're building awareness among people, it's important to do both above the line and below the line marketing. Above the line is whenever they see you across different platforms and content, but below the line is more that one-on-one connection that you build with founders in the entire ecosystem, whether it is your portfolio founders or non-portfolio founders, which is essentially what we banked on to get our outbounds and to get that first few high potential founders that we wanted to partner with in the initial stages. But I would say that, you know, that's the first problem. The second problem is really through whatever we were saying we wanted to solve. Are we really bringing enough value for that founder to believe that we are going to be a positive influence in their journey and help them achieve their goal? And for us, that was almost the very first thing that was in our mind, that if we are entering a cap table, then can we do something to improve their chances of success? See, we know that we can't make or break a company, right? If a VC had that sort of power, there would be every single large VC's company would be a unicorn, right? But what we can do is that come up with two or three tangible things that we can bring to the table that can improve their chances of success and outcome. And even before we went to give a term sheet, even like we had this policy that in our IC itself, you would want to highlight how can we bring value. And I think with that disciplined approach, is much easier to convince founders why you should be on the cap table. And it has worked out, I would say, decently well for us so far.
Yeah, and absolutely, your portfolio speaks for that, you know, some very, very stellar founders. And to be able to do that as a first time fund, you know, it definitely shows that you're doing something right and the approach is right. And not just like in terms of pitching what you can do, but also following through with action. And it's a small ecosystem still, right? Especially at the early stages, and word gets out pretty fast. So building that credibility is tough. But if you are following through what you're pitching and what you tell them you'll add value with and actually following through with action, I think that goes a long way. The other thing I want to talk about, and this is kind of a extension of the thread that you brought out earlier in terms of the importance of community, right, for early stage founders, because there's so much for them to figure out, especially when they were starting a company for the first time, having that community that is going through a similar phase and probably slightly more senior, which has gone through that and can guide you with resources, with their network, definitely helps. But I think the same applies to, early stage VCs as well. Like if you're starting a first time fund, you need that circle of mentors, a circle of peer VCs that can help you out, be there to support you, you know, as and when you have question or as and when you need, their help. So just want to hear from you, you know, how important was that for you when you started Eximius as well? Like, were there specific mentors, peers that you relied on or took advice from, especially when you were starting this for the first time?
Well, absolutely. I think it's very important, right? Because a lot of the success really sort of depends on how you view that particular space and that problem statement and your connect with that problem statement. And as a VC, when we are investing at the idea stage, or I would say even MVP stage, it has to be dependent on what our experiences have been and how that helps us see that problem statement in a broader perspective or in a deeper way. And it's important that when you sort of doing that you bring as many different thought processes and as many different experiences as possible onto it. Of course, not too much to make it a very muddy and difficult decision, but at the same time, enough so that just your particular journey doesn't define how you are taking decisions. So we took both internal and external approach there. Internally, we have an advisory board of three other members outside of myself that take every single decision, every single major decision about the fund. That has been quite helpful, right? Like the people who worked with Series A plus companies, we have entrepreneurs who have seen the 0 to 1 journey a couple times, and we have folks that have run large enterprises with 50,000, 60,000 people. So they bring us diverse experience. And then outside of that, and externally as well, we have industry experts across the three segments that we operate in, fintech, health tech, and gaming, to bring their unique perspective about how it is like to operate and build in those segments. And we usually combine those two thought processes to be able to get a better view. It has been incredible, right? Because you can learn so much by speaking to people and understanding and learning from the material that's printed, but folks that are constantly involved for the last 10 years, 20 years, and have seen a lot can bring in that deep thought process that you might miss out for not being in the industry for too long.
Yeah, and all through very different perspectives, right, from their own vantage point.
No, absolutely. And it has worked. I would recommend that, even folks that are solo GPs definitely build an advisor pool or have that close network of people that can help you bring in different diverse perspectives.
Per, moving forward, you've raised the first fund, which is, almost a $10 million fund. How do you think about Eximus going forward, right? Where do you see might be the evolution of Eximus from here on? And how do you try to approach this dynamic in terms of, trying to institutionalize the fund or trying to make this something which, might go beyond your journey as a fund manager?
That's a great question, because that was the very first thing that I knew even before I started, that, this has to go beyond the first fund and has to go hopefully beyond my journey as well, right? As the way we even thought about Eximus One was more like an MVP, that if this was a minimum viable product, then what are the different aspects that we need to sort of think about to have an edge? How do we have one of the best proprietary deal flow that is possible? How do we improve access and evaluation process? How do we have an edge in being able to help our portfolio companies? So the idea was to identify the different pillars that can that are important in a fund manager's journey and try to build edge there. But as we move forward, we want to hit our PMF, right? We want to hit our product market fit and really be able to showcase that, we don't need to do this just at a small scale, but if we were to sort of put in a decent check and be able to increase our fund size, we are still able to keep up with that edge and continue to double down with that edge to be able to take it to the next level. So our goal is, of course, to reach a triple digit $1 million fund. All of these things that we are doing today, from community building, deeper sort of thesis and relationships, and building a deeper global network, is in that direction of moving from our MVP right now to PMF, and hopefully from this PMF down to a scalable sort of fund model where we can continue to raise larger funds. And not just larger funds, but across different strategies, right? So we can make as much impact as possible across different segments. We're not just early stage founders, but help student founders as well and late stage founders as well. So that is how we view the progress of Eximus from here on.
Yeah, I like the fact that you put it out as a very parallel founder journey where, you're talking about proving your first or the MVP, the minimum viable product first, before going wide, before going broad, and before, scaling big from here. And which, underscores, how similar the journey is, especially for a solo GP or a first-time fund manager when they're starting their own venture fund. So I'm sure there are a lot of lessons from all this experience for both VCs as well as founders, that are early in their journey. Paul, one question before we get into the rapid fire, and this is, what inherent personality traits of yours do you think make you suited for this job as a venture investor?
As I would say, the first one is being able to understand a founder's journey. I've seen this and I've sort of validated this, that within the first 30 minutes itself, I'm often able to tell how much conviction the founder has in the problem statement and the product that they're building. And I think that's a very, very important skill set to have as a VC, right? To be able to see across, because sometimes founders themselves don't really know how much conviction they have. But it's reflective in the way that they communicate that conviction to you. So really being able to read between the lines and being able to say that. And then the second I would say is just my journey across, right? Different, meeting different sort of people, being interacting with people from all walks and journeys of life has shaped the way I operate and build relationships with people as well. And I think both of those are very important in any venture fund manager's journey.
Totally agree to that. All right, Pearl, it's been a great conversation so far. Let's jump into, our final segment, which is the rapid fire. I'll shoot some questions and hope to get your honest, immediate thoughts on the same.
Yes, looking forward to that.
Okay. First question, one thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem today?
Reduce the amount of paperwork that is required to get a funding done. On average, we need 50 documents and please, not needed.
If you had to give a TED talk, what topic would you choose and why?
I think it'd be around the world in 10 years. So I think that has a lot to do with how I build, view, and again, to point, build relationships.
VCs and founders from the ecosystem that you admire and look up to?
And for VCs, it'll have to be the Pai brothers, Pranav and Siddharth. Quite amazed in terms of how they have gone about building 314 in such a short span of time. One of the youngest in the country and also one of the first domestic funds to really sort of go out there and make it big, right? So I would say that they're quite an inspiration to the next generation of VCs and hopefully entrepreneurs as well that are coming up. For entrepreneur, I quite admire Bhavin Thrakya. Of course, don't know him personally, but whatever I've heard of online through his videos and content really portrays that eye to building and has a unique perspective in terms of how he wants to build not just successful venture of businesses, but also profitable and sustainable businesses.
Pearl, this has been amazing, talking to you. And, any final thoughts, closing thoughts for both current and aspiring founders that are listening to you through the podcast?
Well, I would say that in the last couple months, we've seen a lot of negativity spreading across the entire ecosystem in terms of capital available, whether we should build or not. My only advice to founders would be that whether you're planning to start this journey or you're already in this journey, if you believe in your problem statement, bear markets are the best to build and don't stop. Continue building. Funds will follow you if you have the right customer segment and solution available. So don't let the negativity stop you at all.
I think that's a perfect note, Pearl, to end a podcast and a conversation today. It's been a pleasure having you on the show, Pearl. And I've learned a lot, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners will also take away a lot from this conversation. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Diksha. It's a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for having me and look forward to chatting more offline.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruna podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guests know about it, share your thoughts on social media, and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.